Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Fred Portnoy as my great producer. So as you've come to expect on The Attitude, we begin every show with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. I'm going to remind you that it is the voice of a patriot. It's the voice of someone who can speak truth to power. It's the voice of a proud immigrant who turned to his father and assured him it would be all right. We've come to understand it was not all right for him, not for his twin brother, and frankly, it's not all right for the rest of us. So part of the reason why we keep replaying it every single day and will until November of 2020 is that his words, his voice, and his courage should be in your ears when you exercise the franchise this election.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Joining us right now is Sharon Lerner. She writes for The Intercept, and there were two pieces that Sharon wrote. The first piece that she wrote at The Intercept was entitled, "Drug Companies Continue to Shed Liability for Rushed Coronavirus Treatments." No surprise, Sharon. And then the second one is about PFAS and the contamination which divided an Alabama town. And if we have time, I want to touch on both. But because we know there is so much pressure on everyone to somehow figure out how to deal with this pandemic, I really need to start with your piece about the drug companies and their liability issues. So why don't you talk to us a little bit about this piece of legislation, an amendment to the PREP Act. Never heard of the PREP Act, didn't know they did this, but why don't you sort of walk us through what the pharmaceutical companies have been able to do? Not only have they been given billions to quickly come up with some kind of a vaccine, but they also have the best of both worlds. It doesn't have to work, and they'll be protected from liability. So welcome to the program, Sharon.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, so this piece was looking at liability, which the PREP Act that you mentioned actually is an old piece of legislation. It originally passed in, I think it was 2005, but it was updated this year to deal with the pandemic. And it was actually updated in the spring. I think it was in February and in April. Mm-hmm. But nobody seemed to pay attention. And the reason I wanted to write this piece now is because there has been a lot of pressure and a lot of attention from Trump, you know, to the idea of let's get a vaccine out by Election Day. And of course, the idea for him is, okay, he's going to hopefully get a vaccine and then he will be the savior, and then, you know, presumably right. He'll win a second term. But we've been hearing from the experts since the beginning that in order to do the science the right way, it takes time, and that there are real risks from rushing it. And, you know, there are all sorts of risks that I go into in the piece, you know, from just not working to harming people. Mm-hmm. And these things, you know, presumably you could take some risk when you're trying to save lives. And I understand the urgency here. I think everybody does. And so this whole, you know, when you approach vaccines and treatments, there's this balancing act to be done. But I think people who know about vaccines and know about medicines realize that there are always risks, even when you do it slowly, but certainly more when you do it quickly. And so in the context of that, it seemed really important to look back at this update to the PREP Act from April, which made it really clear that companies can't be sued in court for damages caused by any vaccines, medicine, any what they call medical countermeasures for COVID-19.
So that, I want to read your article, Sharon, because I think it's really important that people hear this as you wrote it. According to a law passed this spring, pretty much nothing.
Which is an answer to what can you do? What will people be able to do if they discover they've been harmed by the product that was brought to market hastily?
Okay, so
very specifically, the law says if for the products related to COVID-19,
right,
you can't sue. So you can't go to court over that. And there's one exception, which is in the case of willful misconduct, which is, you know, and someone purposefully is trying to harm you, which I think is almost impossible to prove, right? But even in that circumstance, they've raised the bar. So it's basically impossible to do anything if anybody gets harmed. And I think that, I'm not saying people will, but there's certainly the chance. And typically, for harms that come from vaccines, which have happened in the past on occasion, there's actually a fund that has been set up to deal with this in the 80s called the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. And the PREP Act specifically says you can't use this. So people for a COVID-19 vaccine, they won't be able to use that program. So really it's very clear that that there will be no legal recourse. And I just think it's important in the context of rushing, you know, and I, again, understand the importance of getting these drugs and getting vaccines, we need them. But the way this has been set up, where there's political pressure to expedite them for the purpose, you know, Trump has said, and he literally said that, you know, getting a vaccine by election day wouldn't hurt his chances. So he's admitted that he's interested in this.
Well, and so let's remember that this is an administration that doesn't believe the science, that has muzzled the doctors, that has manipulated the numbers, that has basically been reluctant to test, that basically if you watch the Republican convention, you would have thought the pandemic is over. You know that whatever he does is not about your health, it's not about your safety, it's about his reelection. So you have to put all those things through that lens, Sharon, which makes, you know, the feeling of safety and security in a vaccine kind of a very tenuous relationship. And there is a difference, Sharon, let's be honest here. I understand the idea of expediting something when you're talking about a treatment, because that means you've got COVID and you need to figure out how to treat it. You might be on your deathbed, there might be something here, but you've got the disease. The purpose of a vaccine is to prevent you from getting the disease. That means all the people who are not, you know, they're not sick, but
right,
they want to get the vaccine because they're not sick and they don't want to get sick. And that means that the vaccine in some ways has to be even more trusted because you're allowing people, you're encouraging people who are healthy to run the risk of embracing a vaccine that you know has not gone through the normal testing situation. You know that the president who's pushing it is being very political. And as you point out, there are 120 vaccines that are already sort of being looked at, and who knows which one we're going to get. And we don't know necessarily what the consequences are. And now we're being told, oh, but no problem, there'll be no liability issue for the companies that are coming up with it. So what's going to protect us from them doing things that sort of cut corners because they know they're protected?
Right, I mean, nothing. Oh,
it's, I mean, the whole thing is so shocking. And you had you talked to a bioethics professor, and he said that the sweeping protections are, quote, an extreme departure from the norms. And let's be honest, we're in a pandemic. So we know that whatever is going to happen, it's not going to be the norm. Okay. I mean, by definition, in some ways, because of this, but you've got not only a departure from the norm, you've got a president who's a departure from the norm as well.
Right.
So what, here's my problem. They make money no matter what they do. They've been handed billions no matter what they do.
It's true. So the amounts of money, which I haven't seen well reported anywhere. I haven't seen quite a good tally of the numbers. When I was looking through some of the documents for this piece, I saw that between now and 2024, BARDA, which is this division of HHS that deals with these medical countermeasures, has $27 billion. Yeah. Another part of HHS also has $25 billion. So right there, that's $52 billion. It's just these sums, that extraordinary amounts that we have not seen in the past. So it's this crazy frenzy with, you know, you have to remember in this country in particular, there is just a very intense business side to pharmaceutical, you know, development. It's a huge moneymaker. It's already found ways to pare back liability, to make sure that that companies maintain the ability to profit from drugs even when they're funded by taxpayer dollars, which is the case with one of the drugs that I describe later in the piece. But we still usually have some ways of, you know, for people who are harmed, for suing, and it's just not the case anymore. And of course, with all these drugs, we're desperate. We're looking, as we should, at all sorts of options. And the drug that I ended up talking about was a drug that came up in Rick Bright's whistleblower complaint that you may remember from the spring. And yeah, his concern was that, you know, drugs in the same class had caused malformations of the skull and teeth. And so he said, hey, you know, when this company had sought funding, which is the way he described it, the company disputes it, but basically there are emails that show them discussing this. Anyway, they sought money. He did not want to move ahead because he wanted it to go through trials before they got any funding from BARDA. And what's interesting is that, as I read about in the piece, the CEO of the company was actually pushing for the designation of COVID-19 as a material threat, which is just like, huh, what does that mean? But it turns out that this little clause, if it is officially declared that, then pharmaceutical companies will be able to sell drugs back to the government even before they're approved by the FDA.
So then what's the point of the FDA? So wait a minute, not only do they shed liability, not only they've been given billions of dollars, but if it's because this type of threat, they can sell it back to the government. They can sell it before the FDA has approved it. I mean, this is about as loosey-goosey as you can get. And part of the problem I have with this whole story and the billions that are on the line and the health and well-being of thousands, millions of people, is that you also know that relationships with this president moves you to the top of the pack. Relationships with this president means that he might embrace that idea of it being some kind of, you know, material threat, because again, it's about the politics. This is a time when you want people to feel safe and secure. And I'm telling you, everything I read in your article, all the boxes that were being checked off were like, would I take this? Would I trust this? You know, where's my pillow guy in this conversation? Because it just feels like not only is it too fast, but I don't trust the man who's pushing it.
Right. Yeah.
Oh my God, Sharon. Oh my God. So I told someone that I was interviewing you about this and I sent her the article. And here's what's so interesting. If you've been following anything at the Harvard School of Public Health, the Chan School, they've been talking about the fact that maybe before we get the vaccine that we can trust, and we already know like 50% of the population, I've already said they're probably not going to take the vaccine. So what's a vaccine if 50% of the population don't take it? Mm-hmm. But what they've been suggesting is that we have these very quick home tests, you know, something that you could sort of, you know, put your saliva on, you know, drop in a little container, cost about $1, and it's like not 100% accurate, but very, very close to being pretty accurate. And if you had that kind of simple testing that you could test every single day, that would almost have the effect of a vaccine. But here's the good news. If I spit on a piece of paper, there's no harmful effect.
Well, I think that a vaccine would be a great thing, and I think people should try to develop one. But
I'm not saying that they shouldn't develop one. But what I'm saying is that this could be an alternative as we give the vaccine time, so that we know it's gone through the tests, so we know that the result is something we can trust.
Well, certainly, I think that you shouldn't rush the science. The consequences when you're millions and worldwide billions of people potentially taking it. I mean, if you need to figure out before you give it to that many people if it's going to cause side effects or problems, you know, you need to test it. So I don't think it makes sense to, you know, obviously it doesn't make sense to rush. And even if you don't rush, you have the potential for problems because we've seen them before.
Well, it's going to be very interesting, and I was not aware of the. I'm not surprised by the liability story. I mean, we know the companies are asking to shed liability as well. I mean, that's the other thing that's happening. They don't necessarily want to protect their workers, so they're basically saying, you know, if someone comes down with COVID, you know, you release me from liability, even though I maybe didn't create the safe workspace. And now we're having something when you hear the drug companies basically doing the same thing. It's not a surprise, but at the same time, it doesn't support the idea of trust. And I think that's the part that people need to understand, is that one of the reasons why you want to hear that there is some skin in the game for the pharmaceutical companies is that they will be more aware of the consequences and be more concerned about the consequences because they're going to have a financial impact. And that's usually how companies respond. They don't respond because they want to act good. They respond because they want to do well. It's all about money. So thank you for this. I didn't even know about it, but if nothing else, it reinforces everything I expected from this president. Unfortunately, everything I expected when we're talking about this pandemic is that we're going to rush the science, even as we're told not to trust the science. And that's so depressing because both of those things are coming out of Donald Trump. You know, he wants to ignore it, but yet he wants to embrace it. And that's where I think the confusion lies. So you also wrote another article. And the other article, we only have about 10 minutes, but I have to talk about it because you wrote an article about PFAS. And it's so funny because it's a contaminant. And when I think of PFAS, I think of two things. I think of New Hampshire and peas and the whole story about PFAS at peas. And I also think of Sharon Lerner because you have been working on this issue, Sharon, for so long. And the piece that you wrote at The Intercept, as someone said in one of the comments, this piece is unbelievable. It's like a movie script because you can't believe it's happening in America and that it's related to something that can contaminate and really harm people. And yet in this tiny town in Alabama, it's got everything. It's got guns, it's got threats, it's got everything. And we're talking about people being contaminated from something that everybody knows is already in their water, in the environment in which they live. And yet, despite the fact they know that, they're not able to sort of deal with it effectively. So talk to us about the story about this little town in Alabama, because I want people to hear what is going on in 2020. You know, we've known about the contamination issue for a long time, but we're still fighting how to prevent it from actually harming people and for these companies to take responsibility for it.
So Decatur, Alabama is a town on the Tennessee River. It's North Alabama, and it has been a production hub for PFAS chemicals, particularly 3M has a big plant down there. And for decades, they've been making and using PFAS. First it was PFOS and PFOA, the ones that were involved, the chemicals that were involved in West Virginia in that famous suit. Mm-hmm. And they stopped using those in around 2000, 2002. And introduce replacement chemicals like DuPont did too. And all those chemicals are now in the river and also in soil around the area. Thousands of acres have been contaminated because at some point, for a long time, the company has admitted to for 20 years, what they did was they purified some of their wastewater by like filtering it. And basically the stuff that's left over is called sludge. And it's like this really contaminated stuff that they sold to farmers to use as fertilizer. Oh, and it was spread for 2 decades on I believe it was 5,000 acres. But anyway, and it got it. And so the chemicals that we're talking about, they don't deteriorate. They don't degrade on their own. They don't break down. And so what happens is they go from the sludge into the soil, into the food that's grown into the soil, into the animals that eat the food that's grown into the soil, in the soil. So they just sort of cycle through. And, but also some of the chemicals went directly into the river and particularly went downriver to a community that I write about called Cortland. And so what happened in the town is that for many years, for decades even, while the company was aware of this, the people who lived down there were not. And only recently did they kind of wake up to what was going on with this. There have been a couple lawsuits as sort of the information trickled out, partly because of what happened in West Virginia, partly just because it's been in the news and because of, you know, the EPA began to do a few things on it. Anyway, as they began to become aware, some folks in the city council started trying to address it, basically, and the whole town just has been sort of divided and fighting over it because it is, I guess the polite term is industry friendly, and basically the companies that are located in there, there are a lot of them. They give money for schools and for, you know, to the United Way and local charities. And the local government, the city government, is very much entwined with these companies and have, there's one lawyer down there who represents the city on litigation around this, who's actually being paid by 3M and has essentially, anyway. And so the whole town was, particularly the city council was fighting about this, and it came out that this lawyer who was being paid by 3M was actually working behind the scenes to get the city council members who opposed, who were trying to call attention to the chemicals out of office. And this piece ran 2 days before their election, and I'm sorry to report that both of them were in fact voted out of office.
So I let me just read you the comment under here, because I really want people to read this. I'm going to post it on my Facebook page. Here is one of the comments under your piece. My God, this thing read like a mob movie script. Are these people lawyers, politicians, and industrialists, or gangsters? Threatening people, vandalizing their cars, frickin' bananas and frickin' tailpipes. What the hell? So we can't eat apples from Decatur? What else can't we eat from where? So he just goes on and on as he read your piece. And it, honest to God, I mean, you read it and you almost need a roadmap, because it's like, it gets so complicated. People are backstabbing everyone. It's dividing the town. It is unbelievable. Here's a lawyer who's supposed to be representing and protecting the best interest of the city. But what's the best interest of the city? Is it keeping people healthy or keeping the company happy? I mean, that's really what I thought was just so amazing. And as you point out, they decided that, you know, there were two members on the city council who are concerned about the health and safety of the residents of Decatur. Guess who lost? The two people who care about the health and safety of people in Decatur. And once again, who rises to the top? But the Chamber of Commerce and the company. And so the company will spend money on some nice little tchotchke for the community, even as people get sick. And that's the part that sort of blows my mind, is that we have known how dangerous this is, and still 3M is getting away with it, you know, and still it's dividing a community up. And I have to ask you the question, Sharon, what's the role of the federal government here?
Well, the federal government has done less, certainly than it should, very little at this point to regulate and restrict these. I mean, it basically brokered a voluntary phase out of PFOS and PFOA, but that was years ago. And in the meantime, all these replacements have come in. They haven't set binding regulation. And it is because of those failures, those regulatory failures on the federal level, that you see this kind of thing happening in Decatur. I mean, obviously there are communities across the country that are dealing with similar issues, but it's really, it depends on where you are. And so in Minnesota, the attorney general sued 3M, same company that we're talking about here, got $850 million for her state. In Alabama, it's quite a different picture. Right. I mean, they don't have the same approach to regulation. They have a very different approach to industry in general. ADEM, which is their state environmental, I don't even want to say regulatory agency because they call it, it's management, but basically they have not been cracking down in any way on the company. And they, in fact, were aware of the 20 years of sludge spreading and approved it. And they, you know, they have been very much a partner with the company. And so they recently entered into a consent agreement about how to clean it up. But there are a lot of, basically, it essentially leaves the cleanup to the company and the state. And many people feel like that's not gonna be very effective.
Well, I mean, again, once again, you need someone who can stand up to 3M. And what you get in Alabama is you get nobody. They're all sort of caving. And so it's left to people on a city council. And as you point out, it not only did it divide the community, but the two people that were targeted by 3M lost. So who's the big winner here? And of course, part of the problem is that what these companies understand is they can spend their money. And while they won't address the PFAS that's been spread around, they can spread their cash around. And one of the lines in your piece is, these chemical companies donate what seems to be large amounts of money towards projects like an amphitheater, which makes them look like great citizens. But frankly, the cleanup costs are far more than these charitable donations. Their money would be better spent getting rid of the chemicals. So in the end, what do? They sort of drag their knuckles. The chemicals are still there and they have a nice amphitheater. But is that good for the people that live there? Probably not. Sharon Lerner, when it comes to this issue, you have never let go of it. So thank you so much for raising it and keeping us aware of it. And again, it's a situation where, can you leave it to these states or these communities? You need something bigger than 3M to step in. And at least during the Trump administration, you'll never see it. Yeah. So thank you very much for joining us. I really appreciate it. Keep writing that stuff at The Intercept.
Thank you, Arnie. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Fred Portnoy. We'll be right back.
You were the life. You paid your dues. And the dirt slipped through your hands. The crops are sown. And the damage done. And you leave it to God's name. From his car, pulling up your driveway. Sip a slicker, banker on the run. Smell the want and the fire in his taking. Gotta pay the rent or the farm is gone. Your farm is gone, 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 gone. Your farm is gone, gone, gone. You work the land, paid your dues, and the dirt slips through your hands. And the crops are sown, and the damage done.
Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Fred Portnoy. Again, I want to remind everyone that we Zoom on Tuesday afternoon, so something should happen Tuesday night. You'll hear about it on Thursday. So a friend of mine lives in Ames, Iowa. And my friend in Ames, Iowa, saw this article at The Guardian, and she said, you've got to read this article. It's so depressing, but so beautifully written, and it really describes sort of the life we're living, the fear we're experiencing, and what it's like in places in the Midwest, like Iowa. And the person who wrote the piece is named Art Cullen. He is the editor of the Storm Lake Times in Northwest Iowa, where he won the Pulitzer Prize for writing editorials on agriculture. He is a Guardian US columnist and the author of the book, Storm Lake, Change, Resilience, and Hope in America's Heartland. So let me first welcome Art to the program. How are you, Art?
Great. Thanks for having me, Arnie.
Well, when she
and
sent me that
from Iowa, Minnesota.
Yeah. Well, having gone, I've gone to St. Olaf, you know, and my daughter went to the University of Iowa. So I feel like I have a connection to the Midwest in so many ways. It's unbelievable.
How about you?
How about you? That's right. Every time I talk about St. Olaf, I go, yeah, sure, you betcha. So there you go. Although my name is Arnie Arneson, but I look like either an Italian Jew is really what I look like, but don't tell anyone. So the title of your piece at The Guardian was as follows. Trump must win the Midwest, but out here, his breezy reelection gambit falls flat. We're more concerned about drought, economic uncertainty, and COVID than right-wing talking points about crime and socialism. Now, Art, I'm going to do something I think I've only done 3 times in my entire career, and I've been doing this since 1988. This piece is so powerful and so incredibly well-written. I want you to read it because you paint a picture, and not that I don't trust you verbally, but you paint a picture and you bring in so many points that I want people to see the picture you painted at The Guardian. Because when I got done, I was almost in tears. And yet I also understood the level of frustration. And I want people to understand why I so emotionally reacted to your piece the same way my friend in Ames reacted to the piece. Because you're a great writer. And I want people to understand you paint remarkable pictures with words. And this is a picture that really, I think, doesn't just describe what's going on in the Midwest, but it sort of describes the sort of sick feeling so many of us have. And you did a phenomenal job of describing it.
Well, thank you.
So I'm going to ask you to read it. And I may interrupt you. That's my privilege. But I want you to read it because I think it's incredible. Start from the top, and you'll have to tell us what the word D-E-R-E-C-H-O is.
Derecho.
Derecho. Okay. I'd never heard that term. So read the
first
sentence.
Neither had we until just recently.
Oh, good. Well, then I feel better because I literally had to look it up because I'm like, what the hell is this? So
yeah,
start with that
sentence.
It was
invented by some guy from the University of Iowa in the 1880s. Apparently, there was a strong wind, and he called it derecho, which in Spanish means straight wind versus tornado, which is... You know,
a circular. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Straight wind. Okay. A derecho is a straight wind. Thank you so much.
So here we go. It's dry. So dry that my neighbor, Steve Dre, the tractor parts man who hears it first, figures that the combines might start rolling through the brown corn in just a week or two. Some farmers are cutting corn for livestock silage, and it's punky. 150 bushels per acre should catch a lot of it around storm like Iowa, which is in severe drought along with much of the Corn Belt. That's a 25% yield chop off expectations. It makes farmers itch to get after it before the paper dry corn falls to a freak wind. A hurricane like derecho, that's Spanish for straight line wind, flattened 14 million acres in the tall corn state just a couple weeks ago. This is corn prices are at their lowest point in a decade.
Now, let me just repeat that it flattened 14 million acres.
That's 14 million in Iowa.
And oh, my
it went
God.
From Nebraska to Indiana, 50 miles wide.
Oh,
my 700
God.
Miles.
I visually can't even imagine it, but I saw that sentence and I'm like, oh, my God. All right, keep going. But I want people to understand 14 million acres were laid flat. This is like an
corn
incredible
and soybeans blown over.
All right, keep going.
Or as we say in Iowa, blowed over.
Blowed over. Okay, keep going.
The cicadas of late August called children back to school where vulnerable teachers and staff awaited them. Most come from meatpacking households, Latino, Asian, and African, whose breadwinners were ordered into close working quarters in April by a president who demanded slower virus testing. We were among the hottest spots in the land. The infection rate shot up in the college town as the students returned. Governor Kim Reynolds ordered the bars shut down in 6 of the state's 99 counties. She sailed to election in 2018, but has since watched her numbers slide as her mind melded to Trump's. Our virus rate refuses to recede. 14 teacher aides in Storm Lake quit just before classes resumed for fear of infection. The governor ordered everyone back to class, but didn't tell schools how to do it. Our superintendent begged patience. She regrets saying, I just don't know, so often, when asked how to pull this off safely.
I'm going to stop you here, Art. And the reason I'm going to stop you here is twofold. So she shuts the bars down in six of the state's 99 counties. Did that work? Right. I mean, you've got 93 other counties. You can go and grab a beer at a bar.
No, it doesn't work. And even the White House said, you've got to close down more counties. And outlined several more counties where the infection rates are way too high.
Unbelievable.
But, for example,
go on.
Storm Lake is home to a meatpacking plant and a college and a community college. And it is not, and the bars are open.
I want people to hear this. What was she doing? How did she pick the six? What kind of a crapshoot was it? And you and I both know that, you know, six out of 99 is a joke. What you just described of your community tells you that you should have been on that list, if nothing else. But the question is, why were you not on the list? And then I want to go back to the paragraph before where you talk about, you know, the kids coming back to school and they come from meatpacking households. If right. I were a teacher, and I knew where my kids' parents were working, I would be afraid of those kids. I would be afraid of those kids because you know they're not testing enough in the meatpacking plants. You know that COVID has been spread. You know they bring it home to their children. The children may not be showing signs of COVID, but they'll be coming to class. And guess what? If you're a teacher or a teacher's aide, you're going to be afraid of your children.
5% of the workers at 3,000 meatpacking workers in Storm Lake, 5% are tested every week. Just 5%. Yeah. There's no testing at the school, at the schools.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Again, that's why this piece is so powerful. Every time I read a paragraph, I wanted to hit a wall. Because I was because I was so upset. All right, keep going. You're at nobody does know. Keep going.
Nobody does know. The state last week acknowledged that it was disseminating faulty data about COVID infection as recently as July. The meatpacking industry is doing its own testing of employees on a selective basis. Deaths and hospitalizations have ebbed here. Children have their temperatures checked at the school door. We have no idea what the infection rate really is or how long we can conduct classes. Masks are not required, but everyone was wearing them in class here this week. The kids seem to get it. Grandma, who takes care of them after school, is nervous. Wow. It's shouting distance of Labor Day, when people normally start fixing on the elections. Labor is restless. John Deere laid off Davenport and Waterloo workers last fall and this spring. Deere reported strong profits last week as a result, despite slumping sales from the Trump trade wars. There's the disconnect between the stock market and Main Street. The Dow rises while enhanced unemployment benefits expire. Atop all this, a pandemic, a climate crisis inspiring a mega drought and derecho, rotten farm prices, and incompetent government. Another unarmed black man was shot, this time in Kenosha, Wisconsin, not so far from Minneapolis, where George Floyd became a household name. Now it's Jacob Blake, whose mother, Julia Jackson, pleaded for prayer and healing on national TV for her son, for the police, for this nation. The Bucks and Brewers refused to play.
So let me just stop you here. So what you described, Jacob Blake's mom, that's what a leader sounds like.
Right.
She's asking for healing for her son, for the police, for this nation. And as we tape this right now, Art, you know where Donald Trump is. He's in Kenosha talking to the cops.
Right. And we did not want to talk with Julia Jackson.
Exactly.
Who is apparently one of the most reasonable people in Kenosha.
Exactly. That's why when you said that, I'm reading what she's saying and I'm thinking, oh my God, the contrast between her, where she has risen to the occasion, where she's thinking more about the stability and the security of everyone. And he is working the divide. He is working the divide no matter what the consequences are. It's just appalling. All right. I'll be quiet. Keep going.
Yeah. We'll go next paragraph. Trump simply must win Iowa and Wisconsin. So he cast a convention against this backdrop of schadenfreude. Godless looters are coming for yours. and roped in our governor, former Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, and Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa to play in the tragedy. Few were inclined to listen. When the corn calls, you're too busy removing fallen trees from your machine shed. Trump dropped into the Cedar Rapids airport for an hour shortly before the convention to promise assistance from the derecho that pulverized our second city. After he left, he approved homeowner and business relief for just one of the 27 counties that the governor had requested.
Let me repeat that sentence. Wait a minute, don't go on. After he left, the he is Trump, he approved homeowner and business relief for just one of the 27 counties the Republican governor had requested. The Republican governor who spoke at the Republican convention. I just want people to understand, she asked for 27, he gave her one. And in your next paragraph, I think you say something about the fact that she says that Trump has your back. And I'm thinking, really, who's back?
Oh my God. Anyway.
Yeah, exactly. All right, keep going. That number alone was like a mind blowing.
Yeah. Senator Joni Ernst, excuse me. For that, Governor Reynolds told the TV convention that Trump had our back.
Oh, God.
Senator Ernst, trailing Democratic challenger Teresa Greenfield in fundraising and polling, landed a primetime cameo to praise her fearless leader. The one who knocked down soybean prices, the one who helped the corn-fueled ethanol industry implode, the one who ordered children into cages to be separated from their mothers.
All right, so Art, you're from Iowa, so I'm going to put you on a couch because I feel like I need therapy, but I'm going to put you on the couch and say, so tell me, Art, why the hell did Joni Ernst do this? Why the hell did she do this? What is the upside for her? I mean, I'm looking at the polling numbers. I was looking at everything. I'm looking at what you just described in your article at The Guardian. And I'm trying to figure out who is the consultant that suggested she do this, or is she tired of politics and wants a way out?
Well, first of all, she is not a certified brain surgeon. Mitch McConnell is doing the thinking for her and Chuck Grassley. Okay. And he's just telling them what to do. And if you want his money, that's what you do.
Wow.
And so that's what she does. And
but
she
doesn't he need that warm body? He doesn't to lose Joni. I mean, it's already a very slim margin that keeps the majority leader in power. And if Mitch McConnell is playing the long game, not the game for like an hour, then he wants Joni Ernst to look as appealing as possible in a state that's hemorrhaging. And what she did during the Republican convention was not useful. And again, if I were running against Joni Ernst, I would remind everyone that her leader, when they were asking for 27 counties to get some sort of assistance from the federal government, President Trump only managed to figure out how to support one. I mean, I would just slap everything against Joni, and I don't think it helps her. I think it only hurts her. And I think Mitch McConnell is cutting off his nose to spite his face.
Well, yeah. And I think there's a certain amount of hubris that's built up from power, and maybe Mitch McConnell doesn't get it. He might be in trouble in Kentucky himself.
Exactly. All right. It's just, I'm reading all these things and I have 1,000 questions as to why are you doing this? What does this mean? And from the governor's perspective and Joni's perspective, they're attaching themselves to, you know what, and I can't use the word on the radio.
Yeah.
All right. Keep going. Farmers are anxious.
Latinos are afraid. Unemployed machinists are frustrated. That prize demographic, suburban women from Urbandale next to Des Moines, are encouraging their school board to sue the governor over her in-person school orders. A few Latino organizers gathered in the park on the sweltering evening when Trump would commandeer the Rose Garden for his reality show. Our people came here to be free of the corruption and violence, said Storm Lake City Councilman Jose Ibarra. Now it's come back to find us. Where can we go? What can we do but vote?
Let me just repeat that again. That was one of the most poignant two sentences in your entire piece. And I'm going to read it too. A few Latino organizers gathered in the park on the sweltering evening when Trump would commandeer the Rose Garden for his reality show. Quote, Our people came here to be free of the corruption and violence, said Storm Lake City Councilman Jose Ibarra. Now it has come back to find us. Where can we go? What can we do but vote? Oh my God, Art, that sentence made me sick. It made me sick because he knows what corruption is like. He understands violence. That's why they fled. That's why they came here. And what is he seeing in the streets, even in DC, in Kenosha, in Portland, all over the country? It's violence. And it's violence that's not being sort of tapped down, but being inspired by the man who's sitting in the White House.
Yeah, and this is what my father fought against in World War II.
Oh, God. It was an amazing sentence. All right, I'll stop. You only have a sentence left to go. Keep going.
They said their older folks who never saw a reason before have finally found one to vote. Even some of those farmers wondering about Trump as they dig, even some of those farmers are wondering about Trump as they dig into a harvest so meager that wraps up as they vote. An ill wind blows for incumbents.
Oh my God, Art. You know, you keep thinking about the fact that he can still win. You keep thinking about the fact that, you know, some people have drunk the Kool-Aid and no matter what happens, they still believe. But I think if what you're describing in Iowa is what is in effect and probably even worse by November, how do you vote for this man? How do you do it? Do you not care about your children? Do you not care about your future? Do you not want, I mean, what is safety and security if he's in office? Because he actually defines the opposite of both of those words.
Yeah, well, when you've kind of been under the boot for so long, you begin to believe your own stories. And a lot of people here do believe their own stories. They're so disaffected. And that's Trump's appeal. But he's in a dead heat in Iowa, which he won by 9 points 4 years ago, 3 years ago. I just saw, you know, yet another poll of Wisconsin showing him down 9 points in Wisconsin. So, you know, this is still a state that elected Barack Obama twice and Tom right. Harkin for about 30 years to the U.S. Senate. And right. Wisconsin remains a state that of La Follette that elected a gay woman to the U.S. Senate. Ohio may be lost, but I think Michigan, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa are by no means in the Trump camp, and they have to be poised to capture these states, and I think they are.
Well, one of the lines I have to sort of share with you that I kind of borrowed one of your lines and I applied it to my Republican governor, and you wrote, and I'm going to go back to your article, she sailed to election in 2018, but has since watched her number slide as her mind melded to Trump's. I saw that line, and I hate to break it to you, but I said the same thing about my governor. Yeah. That my governor, Chris Sununu, may appear to be incredibly affable, but what you really need to know is that he is mind melded with Donald Trump, and be afraid and be warned. And I think that's what's so interesting about this whole, Trump has made it all about him. And therefore to distance yourself from him is virtually impossible, whether you're Joni Ernst or whether you're Mitch McConnell or whether you're Kim Reynolds. But when you begin to realize the consequences of being so wedded to Mr. Trump.
He's a tar baby and they can't get away from him and they can't get away from this. This economy was deteriorating. The Midwestern manufacturing economy was deteriorating before the pandemic. It's just gotten worse. And the farmers have been losing money for 7 straight years. And these trade wars were going on before the pandemic and they just destroyed agricultural export markets. And that has ripples throughout the Midwest, from heavy equipment to tractors. This economy is imploding, and while the stock market booms.
Well, but you're looking at and climate change, but you have to add climate change, because climate change means you are facing extremes like you have never faced before. I mean,
absolutely.
That's where people, I keep telling people, we have three pandemics going on. We've got the pandemic COVID, we've got a pandemic of racism, and then we've got the pandemic of climate change. And each one of them takes you out at a different rate.
Right.
You know,
right.
But in the end, they take you out. And, right. and the problem is that with the president, he's kind of a synergistic effect. So in some ways he's actually speeded up the failure of all those pandemics. And that is the problem. And I have said this over and over again, Art, and since you're the writer in the family, I'm going to sort of share it with you. And I keep telling everyone that the pandemic is the economy. The pandemic right. is the economy. You will not fix anything. You will not open schools. You will not return the businesses. I mean, I don't know what's going on in Wall Street, but most of us don't play in Wall Street. You know, most of us still have to feed our families and pay the mortgage and try to figure out how to put gas in the car. And Wall Street doesn't do that for us. It doesn't right. do that for us. You know, and as a result, if we don't continuously connect the pandemic to the economy, then he sort of gets away with the idea that somehow he can fix the economy as if the pandemic doesn't exist. And what everyone has to understand is, until we address that, nothing is fixed.
And then even if you can get beyond the curve of the pandemic, the fact remains that California is on fire. And we might not be able to grow corn in southern Iowa in 25 years because of climate warming. So, yeah, and you're right. They're all connected.
Well, and that's what's so interesting is, not only is he a pandemic denier, but he is a climate denier. And even when he tried to return, you know, all the coal miners to coal, everybody kind of looked at him and said, "Well, you can return them, but we're not buying the coal." I mean, it's like right. That's the irony of all this. It's not a bunch of lefty and granola eaters that are not buying the coal. It's everybody else that's not buying the coal. So, you know, in a lot of ways, he is living in the 1950s. He's never moved beyond the 1950s. If I hear one more word about suburban women, I'm going to give him a knuckle sandwich. You know, because I am so insulted as to how he talks about us, as if, you know, we're Leave It to Beaver. And this is the Donna Reed show he's still watching. You know,
yeah.
and I don't live that.
You're afraid
life.
That a black person will move in next door.
Oh, exactly right. Yeah. And I said this yesterday, and I'm going to say it again. I am so grateful to the NBA. I am so grateful to the sports teams who are really stepping up. And this is the most important time for them to step up, because they are revered and they are respected, and we know they're rich, and we know they can buy anything. The one thing they can't buy is they can't change the color of their skin. And with Donald Trump in power, their children are vulnerable. No matter what gated community they live in, no matter what, you know, elite school they go to, no matter what kind of car they drive, they're still going to walk down the street and be black. And in Trump's America, they are now even more vulnerable. It's amazing, Art Cullen. I'm sorry. Your piece is absolutely remarkable. You are the editor of the Storm Lake Times in Northwest Iowa. How lucky Iowa is to have you there. You won the Pulitzer Prize for editorial writing on agriculture. You can tell as I read your piece, I could sort of smell it, feel it, and taste it. And you are the Guardian U.S. columnist and author of the book Storm Lake: Change, Resilience, and Hope in America's Heartland. So if you could do one thing, Art Cullen, to begin to repair, other than addressing the pandemic, for the place you love, for Iowa, what would you want to see happen to begin to help Iowa repair?
First of all, thank you for your very kind words. And second, the main thing that we need is to plant about 30% less corn. If we could do that, we could heal Iowa. We need to convert our agriculture in a fundamental way to get off this chemical Jones. We are at the end of a 50-year period of chemical agriculure that's exhausted itself. And it's exhausting our soil, it's poisoning our water, And if we planted 30% less corn, we could start to solve the climate crisis and restore rural Iowa.
I'm so glad I asked that question, Art Cullen. I would never in a million years have come up with that answer. But since you got the Pulitzer Prize for editorial writing on agriculture, I asked the exact right person to begin the conversation. Let's hope after the 2020 election, the election that may never end, an election that I'm just praying will give us some kind of closure, but I don't think it will, that people can hear you and recognize that the past isn't working anymore. And if you want to have a safe and secure future, you're going to have to do change, and change is hard. But we need a leader who can help us get to that change.
We can solve the climate crisis. We can through you with agriculture. We can do it.
I believe you. I believe you. Art Cullen, thank you so much. Keep writing that stuff at The Guardian, and I'm going to call you again. So I promise.
Okay.
All right,
thank you, Arnie.
You're welcome. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Fred Portnoy. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Ciao.
I know you deceived me, now here's a surprise. I know that you have, cause there's magic in my eyes. I can see for miles and miles and miles and that I don't know about the little tricks you play, and never see you when deliberately you put things in my way. Well, here's a poke at you, you're gonna choke on it too. You're gonna lose that smile, because all the while I could see for miles and miles. I could see for miles and miles. For miles and miles and miles and miles and miles. Oh yeah. You took advantage of my trust in you when I was so far away. I saw you holding lots of other guys, and now you've got the nerve to say that you still want me. Well, that says maybe, but you gotta stand trial, because all the while